Let's ask Dana a little follow-up on this. Like, how, when we're covering stories like this, how do we add depth to this? How do we add depth to equity issues when we're covering these?
I think you have to let the people on the ground lead. You have to let people tell their own stories. But more importantly, you need to give them the money to do that. They can't be doing this because they're a good person and because they have extra time. Like, people have jobs, and it needs to be funded. Often we expect communities to sort of come to the table and work with us, but for free. And that's not going to work. I mean, bear with me through this analogy, but like, I feel like equity is also often seen in the CBO and funder world as sort of this sprinkle on top of the mobility cupcake. Like, we gotta add it in there, because, you know, you gotta say equity. But it's not that at all. It's like the flour, it's the baking soda, it's a key ingredient that needs to be baked in and part of it from the beginning, and it needs to be funded. But yeah, I think in terms of adding depth, it needs to be getting folks like Eden to advancing the capacity of advocacy organizations to do more trainings and communications trainings, organizing trainings, all sorts of things that these communities can come to and get paid to come to and then learn to be leaders and elevated in their community so that they're the ones telling the story, they're the ones making the change. That all is really hard if the people in power don't do anything, though. That's a harder nut to crack, but I think, just remembering none of us are safe until all of us are safe. And giving the people who are most disinvested in where the highest deaths and injuries are occurring, focusing there first.
Peter, you covered the story a year afterwards in Bicycling Magazine. And we've been starting to see on the national scene, you know, more stories like this. Justin Williams, John Jones here. How have they been received in that global context? Can we have an appetite to tell more stories rather than just the top level stuff about cycling? You know, the personal issues of like how cycling and active transportation, you know, affect a lot of people's lives.
Well, I think storytelling is a really powerful weapon where you can humanize these issues and these personal tragedies. And then when people read about Woon and how he fought to this place in life that he was at and what was taken from him and his family, then people feel more of a connection to the issue. And my perspective as someone who writes for big national magazine brands like Bicycling and Outside, that those brands are much more interested in this issue than they were a couple of years ago. I wrote a story this past summer about this bike messenger in New York named Robin Heitman, who was killed on Sixth Avenue, and I think that story wound up being in terms of just traffic, their number one story this year, and that, like, when you humanize it, people connect to it. And it's like important for people here to realize that all the challenges that we're facing in communities in LA are just playing out everywhere. Like, all the big cities have the equivalent of a big mobility plan that's collecting dust in some regard. That, like, New York City is already now has more cyclists killed than any year since 1999. We're going to probably have 1,000 cyclists killed in the U.S. for the first time since the 70s. It's like people are on phones, more people are driving SUVs, the number of miles driven just goes up year after year, more people are riding. It's like the people that we're up against like, it's like the whole system is broken and no one's going to invent a time machine to go back to the 1950s, and we just need to solve these problems and it's going to be a battle, right? But it's like telling stories, that way you were describing the bell curve, all these people who are just not waking up thinking they want to get, you know, informed about mobility issues. It's like realizing that there are interesting people whose lives were changed or cut short because they want to get to work 2 minutes earlier, might shift how they think about these issues. And so it's like sometimes just like communicating and humanizing these stories can make a surprisingly huge impact.
I want to follow through this climate psychologist and economist Preston Stokmans talks about, you know, the psychological effect of having to deal with climate change, and I think a lot of the same issues they face, the same thing in terms of what we face in the cycling mobility community, that people all agree it's a problem, but being able to solve these problems when we're asking other people, it's outside their circle of influence. Cognitive dissonance sets in. He was pointing to a study where 4,000 homes were asked to save energy. It was divided into four groups of 1,000. The first group, he told, do it because it's sustainable. The second group, he said, do it because of your kid's future. The third group, he said, do it because you'll save money. The fourth group, he showed how much they were saving next to the neighbors.
Ooh.
That was the group that had the biggest impact on saving energy. And what he's bringing up is that basically telling stories about other people relating their issues to ours is what helps bring people in to thinking about change. You know, the more that they know that other people are doing it, people like them, the more likely we are able to think of ourselves in that light. And I want to continue the discussion. Who wants to comment on how important is storytelling, and are we doing what we need to do in terms of reaching out? When I was talking about that bell curve, you know, getting that middle area of people we need to talk to.
Allison Arieff's story in the New York Times called Cars Are Death Machines. Really good, just, you know, facts and data, but also those stories. And if you read it online, you would read a quote and then the person's face would like slide into frame, and it was just like an amazing experience. And maybe that's the type of storytelling, you know, I say we've given up, I can't talk about death anymore because it doesn't get through to people, but maybe these are the kind of stories we need to tell in our cities, or get people out there with photographers. Like, we have these little rainbow halo things in LA now, which are a really great idea to, and we have bicycle signs too, we have like signs that are supposed to go up in these areas to talk about where cyclists were killed. But you can't even really see them unless you're on foot or on a bike, which is like the most devastating part. I saw one and I, like, if you're in a car, you'd never notice it. You'd never see. So how do we mark these in either the physical areas or in our minds to remind people that every time you step foot out of your house, if, no matter how you're getting there, you are at a very high risk of losing your life. I don't know.
I was just, one of my favorite signs that I saw, it was a gorilla installation in the Elysian Valley area. It just said, drive like your brother died here, drive like your son died here. Mm. Which, in terms of messaging, I was like, oh, I've never seen this before, and that's much better than, like, it communicates everything very, very clearly, because it is, can underscore that you or a loved one, like, you know, you turn left here every single day to get on the freeway, right? Like, so does a whole bunch of other people, so do all their loved ones. And that, I don't know the origin of that specific. I know the case, it was a teenager, it's a freeway exit, that turns left into, there's a crosswalk there. I think it was a 14-year-old who was crossing the street. Somebody blasted through the freeway exit, and that was, it struck and killed him. But I know there was a little engineering change to change the little syncing of that signal, so that way you wouldn't have somebody turning left across that intersection while somebody was in the crosswalk, but at the same time, like, that's, okay, cool. But also, I like the signs at the intersection, drive like your brother died here, something like that, which I thought
every
was, at every intersection, because it really is, it is, like, drive like your kids live here, like those signs, but also I think they're, that seems to clue people in when they're in the driver's seat.
Just in terms of your question about storytelling, I think my experience, like if you're in a community meeting or on social media and you're talking about a road diet and people are like arguing about whether induced demand is real or not and talking about vehicles per hour, and it's like there's so many things you can arm wrestle about, but when you take a story like what happened to Woon, there's just no arguing that he had this beautiful life and the street wasn't engineered properly, and someone who wasn't paying attention sort of exemplified a problem in our culture, and that law enforcement and the judicial system have failed us, that when you tell the stories, you wind up with this narrative that everyone can relate to, and there's just no arguing that something is broken that needs fixing, and that sometimes, as much as we all want to like ply in data, that the narratives of human lives make it clear to everyone what's at stake and what needs to be done. And so I don't think you can underestimate the power of telling stories.
I feel like I've made a lot of documentaries for nonprofits in my 12 years of experience, and we had one really interesting time where we made a documentary in 2010 about a woman who was shackled giving birth on the border.
Mm.
And we made this documentary, and we put it out to a new community, not the immigration rights community, but the women's rights community. And they were mad. They were like, why are you showing this to us? This has no relevance. We don't care about this. We were surprised. So we went back. We wrote a narrative about another story we had heard from the same woman. This was based on a woman, a trip we took to Arizona on a solidarity tour. And, you know, this was a story of a woman whose daughter was assaulted. They were all undocumented, so the daughter came home, told the mom, and, you know, she went to call the police, and the mom was like, the daughter was like, you can't call the police. I won't let you. And then it ended with, you know, what call would you make? And we shared that same narrative story, actors, and script, everything, production company to the same group. People were like, I'm sobbing at my desk, how can I get involved, what can I do? Same exact issue, story told in a different way. I really think it's about getting at people's hearts. Like, numbers, statistics, people don't care, and they don't listen. And they're used to, like, liberals yelling those things at them. They're used to the Al Gore documentary. I think we got to come at them with something a little bit more creative and to get through the empathy.
I just wanted to put in a word for kind of the storytelling aspect of, you know, when you do see the families riding in the bike lane together on the way to school and the people doing it to go to work, you know, and the kind of, you know, making sure, and they don't have to be stories, but just the imagery helps. You know, just so it counters, you know, on that subliminal level. But the other thing that I would say, and I am a mother of teenagers, so this is what I'm seeing, but, you know, they aren't putting up with this crap anymore. They're cutting school and protesting and doing the things that they think matter because they think we're not fixing these problems. And we aren't, obviously, right? So I wonder if it's about engaging the 14-year-olds, you know, and sort of getting in the curriculum more and being with ways that are appropriate for what they can do.
Converting their driver's license.
Well, most of them don't have it because, by the way, it's really expensive to insure a teenage boy driver. But anyway, another story.
We're at 11 o'clock. The quick question?
A quick question, and I will say I think you should have left a little more time for questions from the audience. I'm with families to safe streets, which no one has mentioned. My daughter was killed in Cleveland 10 years ago, and I appreciate that there has been discussion about storytelling. Families to Safe Streets is integrating people into the fights, not just taking their stories and telling it. And I've been part of the CBC, like CalBike, for a number of years, and I've been sort of frustrated that somehow we're marginalized. I coordinate organizers for the Right of Silence in California, and that's not really talked about here either. And there are lots of organizing things that involve the people who are the families of the victims that need to be integrated into the work here. It isn't just telling the story, sort of, oh, thank you very much, you've done your piece, go away. Like, I go to city council meetings, that kind of thing. You're part of the process. And just came back from Vision Zero in New York, with Families for Safe Streets was built into the entire conference.
Yeah, when I started this, I said, we have a lot of space that we need to discover, ask questions, think about how we're talking to other people, because we talk to ourselves a lot. You know, we speak the same language. We are measured by similar metrics. People on the outside, they don't speak the same language, and we're trying to sell this type of infrastructure. If any of you have a chance to see Simon Sinek's talk about the why, it's very pertinent to how you reach people. You know, he says Martin Luther King's the famous speech was, I have a dream, not I have a plan. The last thing I kind of want to talk about is think about the audience who you're talking to. Because, like, you know, for myself, you know, I'm car light. I drive to take my daughter or to get my bike fixed. But the rest of the time, I'm in a car taking transit, you know? But for me to speak to other people around me, to put that life on them, that's a far distance from where they are. You know, for me, like, my little stump speech is the Trader Joe mechanism. It doesn't matter which Trader Joe's you go into, the parking lot is packed. If there's one more car in that parking lot, no one's going to move. And you just say, hey, wouldn't it make sense to go ahead and try biking to the Trader Joe's? You know, you've planted in people's minds that, hey, that's something simple, practical I can do. Because nobody is going to all of a sudden switch from driving cars to demanding having bike lanes in their area for safer streets. So I just want to end today, like, think about the audience who you're speaking with, what it is that may resonate with them, because the world we're living in is not always the world of the people who were our constituents. Anyways, I'd like to thank my esteemed panel here today for this talk. And my name is Zachary Ciclavalli, Sir Hours of All, Dan Variano, Peter Flax, Alyssa Walker, Matt Tinoco, and Barrianos. Thank you so much for being here.